Hello and welcome to the Heritage Radio Network. Our show tonight is sponsored by Hearst Ranch. Tonight we have a Radio Network special. We have three green architects whose focus rests primarily on green landscape and urban design. The panel is bound by a common academic thread. All three study at the Penn Design Landscape School and all subscribe to the Jim Corner School of Thought, which Justine is going to explain to us a little later. We have David Sider. Hi, David.
Hello.
Of Future Green Studios in Brooklyn. You can find more info on him and his work at www.futuregreenstudio.com.
That's correct.
We have Martha Despiens of Vert New York Urban Landscape Design. Hi, Martha.
Hi.
And her website is www.vertny.com. And finally, we have Justine Heilner of Justine Heilner Landscape, and it's www.justineheilner.com, H-E-I-L-N-E-R.
Hi.
And basically, Justine, David, and Martha are three young, hip, green landscape architects, and we wanted to get their take on the state of the craft and the future of the craft and on the stakes for cities of going green and of having of incorporating more green architecture and more green landscapes into their into their projects. One thing that you guys have in common is that you're all working in big, shiny, famous firms, and you all branched out and started your own studios. Tell us a little bit about what the impetus behind that was and how you guys all got started as individual bosses of yourselves.
Well, I guess for me, it was when I found out I was pregnant, and I thought that maybe it would be a good time to branch off into my own. I had been starting to do my own projects on the side, and found it really fulfilling as a way to get down to the nitty-gritty details, whereas when you work in a big firm, you work with these really exciting big ideas, but you never really get to figure out how it's actually done. And so for me, it was an easy segue to take a little time off and then start something new.
David?
Yeah, I think for me as well, there was something about sitting behind the computer that was kind of stifling, and that, you know, in working on large scale landscapes, you know, waterfronts, parks, you know, you're looking at anywhere from 4 to 10 year time frames in terms of getting something built. And so the instant gratification of seeing your work and seeing what you can do as a designer and what you can actually build wasn't really there. So for me, that was one of the strong impetus.
Right, it's a great time to experiment with your ideas.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is Justine here, just to distinguish myself from Martha. I also, like David, just found it really hard to fit into the office model. I think a lot of people who get into landscape probably don't do it thinking, I want to work in an office, which Definitely. Is the reality of the job. So figuring out how I wanted to work was really important to me after doing several years of very long hours, and like David said, very long hours on projects that I might not ever be a part of the actual construction of because they were so far out. I guess I was really antsy to be more hands-on and be more material and get to be involved in all the different parts of the project instead of just one part of it.
I mean, a lot of this is easier said than done. I mean, how did you guys attract investors, or how did you guys, you know, collect the capital necessary to begin your own solo projects? And I mean, how did you ensure that your first couple jobs would be successful enough to not sink your companies?
David?
That's a great question.
We're all looking at each other like, how did you do it?
I was actually able to transition. So I was working for a high-end residential firm, working on with celebrity clients, and was able to go down to 2 days a week and start my own practice for, you know, the rest of the week, and
sort of
which was
up.
Actually ending up 5 days a week, so with the 7 day, you know, work week, and that was about 6 months. But, you know, I was able to really transition and, you know, still be bringing in some money to keep things rolling, but build a client base, build a website, you know, start to do some networking and get projects rolling.
Uh-huh. So some of the same clients that you met or that you had worked with at your previous firm, are you now working with on a solo basis?
Not so much clients, but suppliers. Okay. You know, I am a design build firm.
Okay.
So a lot of the relationships that I made with, you know, different subcontractors or different suppliers of materials was instrumental in me being able to take the next step.
Fascinating. Martha, how did you break out on your own?
I did it pretty much the same way as David, is that I cut down to about half time at the office, and then when I took the maternity leave, I took that whole time off, and then when I started up again, I started just for myself. But it's definitely scary, because when you make that decision, you base it on, oh, well, I've had one or two jobs that have gone well, mm-hmm. and you assume that you're going to get some more. But with landscape, you never know how long it's going to be delayed. You have to wait, you know, for the building to get done, and so it was definitely a big, scary risk to take. And you know, the first couple of years were scary, but now it seems like it's starting to be a little more reliable.
So, without being bashful, I mean, are the other students with whom you guys studied having similar success? Have a lot of them broken off independently like you guys have, or are a lot of them still in the same kind of jobs that you guys decided to leave behind?
You know, I think that I can think of one other person who has recently started her own firm in Texas. Can you guys think of anyone else?
Oh, that's the same person I was thinking of.
No, I think you know, maybe the question of personality and how you like to work is part of it.
Right.
For some people, it's fine being in an office or focusing on one thing. You know, everyone has a different skill or way they like to work. So I don't know. It's kind of a hard time to start right now because of the economy, of course. But at the same time, I think as more people are getting laid off or downsized, they're starting to think, well, maybe I want to be on my own now. Also, the question of licensure is an issue for all of us. New York has very strict laws about, they have some of the strictest laws. So we have to do a 5-year internship under a licensed landscape architect. Different states have different requirements for that. So to go out on your own, if you want to get licensed, you're potentially delaying that or putting it off forever.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, how is your firm coping with the economic downturn?
Mine's been pretty slow this year, but it's starting to pick up. When I first started, I worked with a partner who had connections to some very rich clients. And that was a really good way to start. And now I'm kind of building up my own clientele. So it was quiet, but it's definitely starting to hear a little more buzz now.
Yeah, I feel like this summer, I'm getting a little hope. You know, after the winter was long.
This winter was
long.
Hard, you know. For a lot of people, the landscape is not the first priority when they have to cut their budget.
The first thing that gets cut.
So,
yeah.
David has a kind of different clientele, so it might be interesting to hear.
Definitely coming from the design build perspective. Mm-hmm. I think that building projects has allowed me to get a lot of more design built, mm-hmm. essentially, and that some of the projects are smaller, some are larger, just, you know, because the scope of our work, and we keep a very small crew. But I think it kind of harkens back to your question before, was are there other people that are doing this? I do think that there's a return to craftsmanship that's happening now, and maybe it's an offshoot of this whole, you know, green washing.
Do it yourself.
Yeah, but also, yeah, people are getting back to farming. They're getting back to weaving, to craftsmanship, and cooking, and all these different elements of using your hand. And I think it is a disenfranchisement a little bit with the computer and with the method and process of working. But for me, that directly ties into getting business, because, you know, we can take the project from the beginning to the end. And a lot of clients that, you know, may not really hire a landscape architect will hire us to build the project. And that allows me to really implement my design vision, which is, you know, very attractive, and to just have a little bit more freedom with design.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of your projects and your design vision, why don't you guys tell our audience a little bit about the nature of the projects you guys take on a very specific level? What do your studios specialize in?
I could probably go first. For Vera New York, we really like to try to find ways to incorporate green ideas into the urban landscape. So we do a lot of green roofs in the city, and then more like green roof gardens, which seems to be what people are interested in, something where it's really a garden on the roof, not just, you know, a few sedums here, but a way that they can enjoy it, but then also get the green benefits.
And what are the green benefits?
Oh, well, you know, for green roofs, there's things like, you know, you have insulation, you have cleaner runoff, there's less runoff, and so heating costs, so it's sound insulation and heating insulation. So people are into that. And I'm also finding that people are also into just kind of the look of green. Mm-hmm. The people are excited about it right now. So that's our big focus. We also do things, you know, in the outer boroughs in Brooklyn, doing backyards and finding ways that we can do green ideas in that way as well, in backyards with, you know, native plants and finding ways where you don't have to use fertilizer and you can capture the water off of your roof and that type of thing.
What about you, David? You have a couple of projects nearby here, right? Near Roberta's in Bushwick?
I do. And, you know, I think that also ties into getting business in this economic downturn, because I do feel like the green aspect of landscape architecture has actually allowed all of us in a way to get more business.
Definitely.
You know, we were well positioned with our background to take advantage of that when the client actually started demanding that. And so now I work with a lot of developers that are trying to get in that renter or that buyer. And, you know, green is often what young people that are looking to buy their first home or to rent a place, especially in New York, are looking for. And so a lot of times it can be the difference for developers between having the building rented and having it not rented.
Interesting. What about you, Justine?
My projects are a little bit different from David and Martha's. I have done some urban landscapes in the, you know, backyards in Brooklyn, and that's something I do, but most of my projects have been either suburban residential projects or playgrounds. And I guess part of it is me. I'm a very acrobatic person and childlike in a lot of ways. But I think what ties those together is that I'm really interested in the experiential aspect of the landscape and how does it feel to people and how can they immerse themselves in it. And I think, I mean, that brings me to an interesting, since we're talking about green design and we've been going around about this, that how does the user's experience of the landscape fit with green design principles? Can we design a suburban landscape that is appealing and feels good to a typical suburban homeowner that also has an ecological function that works better than the previous model? Or even feels better than the previous model. So that's something I've been trying to figure out through my work.
Well, on that note, let's yeah. discuss the American lawn.
Yeah.
Okay, which in the last 50 years has become the kind of staple of America in a way, an American landscape.
Couldn't be less green.
Couldn't be less green, right? It's probably the most maintenance-heavy plant, the most water-intensive plant that is out there. But, you know, I think to speak to Justine's, you know, question is, can you give somebody a productive ecological landscape or performative mm-hmm. landscape that still offers some of the same benefits of
that same
traditional
feel.
Lawn? Yeah, can you lie back? Can you look up at the stars? Can you
play soccer?
Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to achieve a real change in large scale by forcing people to have something they don't like. You know, they'll just turn away from it. So
we have to get them to like the better solutions.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, just talking a little bit more about the lawn, I think water issues are going to be the biggest issue. I mean, they already are, but people are starting to realize it on a larger scale. Not just that you need to use so much water to water your lawn or your, you know, very decorative, non-native planted landscape. But, you know, if a homeowner is paying for the water, that's an issue. My landlords asked me to design them a garden that they don't have to water because water prices went up 11% last year. But also stormwater runoff is a huge problem, especially in the suburbs. And lawns are basically act like pavement. So some suburbs are starting to make people pay for how much water they put back in or regulate that. That's going to be a real big topic, I think, in the future in the suburbs. And
so, I mean, when the lawn became an iconic symbol of American well-being and comfort, people didn't know any better that it was such you know, an ecological windfall. Mm-hmm. And now I think that people are starting to that ideas, notions that are more ecologically sustainable are becoming also more in vogue. That you look in design magazines and architecture magazines, and all the houses that are touted as the most beautiful are all super efficient, super green. I mean, how long do you think it's going to take for there to be a complete, you know, for old notions of what is attractive and appealing to be eradicated and replaced with newer, greener ideas? I mean, these ideas flourish in cities like New York, but I mean, if you go into some areas of this country, these notions cannot be more foreign.
But I think one particular topic that we could talk about on that is green roofs, okay, which also, you know, like American lawns, deal with the stormwater issue. And New York City, for example, has provided a tax abatement initiative where you can get back $4.50 per square foot for every square foot of green roof that you install on your roof. So there's an issue there with that. I don't know. Could Martha, do you have...
So in other words, legislation is now also starting to coax...
That's what I was going to say, is that I think, unfortunately, or fortunately for us, crisis is causing change.
Right, I feel like it's economic crisis. Yep.
Out west, I think everyone is xeriscaping now, which is the idea of using native plants that don't need any water. People don't have lawns. It's not cool anymore in Arizona. I mean, a lot of people do, but that's not the cool trend. Mm-hmm. Garden Design Magazine, which focuses on suburban Western landscapes mostly, every single issue has, you know, get rid of your front lawn. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, people are getting it. So unfortunately, it's coming out of the places where it's the most crucial at this moment, but you know, it's going to become crucial in other areas too.
Sure. So as a suburban landscape expert, what are some of the alternatives that your studio and your firm works with? Like, what are some of the more appealing alternatives to the traditional lawn that you guys install?
Well, I try to talk about reducing the area of lawn, planting other plants that don't need mowing and can absorb more water if runoff
is an issue. Denser landscaping, basically.
Denser, using native plants.
Right, thinking smartly where you want the lawn, like what you actually want to use it
for.
How
do you use this? And talking a lot with my clients about how do you want to use this place, and also talking about, you know, where is this place? How does it connect with a bigger fabric of landscape? You know, the suburbs in a lot of ways, and I think David was talking about this, have become so anonymous in some way. You know, the style is the same from place to place to place. And I think trying to reseat people's places in a larger context, it's sort of an educational process, but it's a real opportunity also.
Okay. Well, let's go to a quick musical pause, and then we'll talk more about incorporating green designs into urban and suburban landscapes. Hi, and welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network Green Design Special. I'm Lorenzo Reginieri, and we have a panel of young, hip, solo studio-owning green architects here. And just before we went to break, Justine Hallner was telling us about how her studio is helping to radically change notions about what the suburban landscape should be and greening the suburban landscape. Mm-hmm. And Justine, what are some of the other... What are some of your approaches to greening the suburban landscape?
Well, I think, as we were saying before the break, there isn't one single technique. It's more about really understanding how the landscape functions for the user and also how it functions in a larger context and trying to tailor what we do to that. Oh, sorry. So I'll talk to my clients about how are they going to use it. Are there places where they don't need lawn? Can we incorporate more native plants into this? Trying to add habitat value for native insect species, which will then support native bird species. What I'm always trying to do is that the suburbs are huge and they're not going away. And it's becoming almost the only opportunity for reconnecting habitat corridors. So if there's a way to do that, it's kind of like a way of sneaking it in on, you know, somebody's residential landscape. But thinking about things in this bigger way and how do things connect to a bigger context is really important.
What's reconnecting habitat mm-hmm. corridors? Like, to me, that you might as well be speaking German.
Right. I mean, and this is where it's sort of a question of how do you educate your client or how much do you even talk mm-hmm. about it? Or you have to sense out whether it's interesting or not to them. Mm-hmm. But... If we learn a lot in school about patch dynamics and how habitats have become sort of broken up, rather than having a continuous forest, you put a road in and it's suddenly disrupted. And how do plants and animals travel across that disruption? Mm-hmm. And I think that the suburbs are there's just this like great opportunity out there to start working back into that. And, creating little havens for species that are becoming increasingly pressured as the urban landscape sprawls out. And also as agricultural landscape becomes more and more monotonous, there's just less variety. So trying to have more variety in the suburban context it could be great. And I was just going to say that kind of big thinking is something that we're trying to do in urban situations too, with streetscaping and street trees, rather than having one tree pit, maybe you have a continuous trench and you plant more than just the tree with mulch around it. You actually plant around it. There are a lot of different techniques that are starting to be tested in the city as well to try and create a more connected system rather than just a tree by itself, which is it's an object and it looks nice and it creates shade, but it doesn't have a bigger function. And so I think all of us are kind of dealing, you know, trying to do this in with many different techniques and in many different spaces.
Uh-huh. So in a sense, the work you guys are doing is going to make the work that the next generation of green architects does in some ways a lot easier. This is sort of would you call yourselves the guinea pig generation of green architects, or have there been precedents that you guys are learning from?
Well, I think there's definitely precedence, but I would say that landscape has traditionally been thought of as a way of beautifying an environment.
The parsley around the pig is the phrase I've heard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the fact that we're talking about these mm-hmm. things, these, you know, wildlife corridors mm-hmm. and systems and ways, big moves and big interventions in the landscape, I think is, you know, exciting in itself. It's almost traditionally been more in the scope of infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Planners. Mm-hmm.
Right. But I think that the way, you know, to take it to the urban context, you know, streetscapes, drainage swales, you know, different elements like this, but also to get back to green roofs. Mm-hmm. The Design Trust for Public Space in New York estimated that the available rooftop space in New York would equal, you know, if greened, would equal 13 central parks in area.
It's incredible.
So the opportunity is vast to create a system of green spaces that could, you know, really go beyond just aesthetics and really be performative as mm-hmm. well.
Right, and then as we're moving down in scale with Justine doing these, kind of talking about the larger suburban landscape and how that's connected, and David with the green roofs and how they're connected, what I've been trying to do lately is find out, you know, if you have a client that really wants to find a system within their own backyard, like what can
their
they
own
do?
Small context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how can they make a difference? It's just not a token like, oh, look, I put up a living wall. Isn't it beautiful? Mm-hmm. But how you can start to tie it in and have a system, you know, like in the real world, if the water rains, it goes into the earth and it goes into the water system, or it evaporates, goes back to the clouds. It's a continuous system where in the city, what happens is the rain hits your roof and it goes straight down to gutters and it disappears and gets cleaned, and we never get any of the benefits of it. So what I've been looking at way now lately is like, how can we close this cycle so that if you have a green roof, the water that's cleaned from the green roof can then be used for irrigation system. And then using your leaf litter and your vegetable scraps to fertilize your lawn. And so that there's
self-sufficiency.
Exactly.
So basically, the perfect model for existence exists in the natural world. And I mean, it's the job of cities to emulate the models of self-sufficiency that they see in natural environments, isn't it?
In a way, but also making it in a way that works with humans, that, you know, still is productive for us. Mm-hmm. And I think there's kind of the pull back and forth there. Mm-hmm.
So do you think that incorporating green design into the urban landscape is more than just a recent fad? It's more than just part of a movement that's in vogue? I mean, what's really at stake for cities that do or don't decide to go green?
Children's health. I mean, the immediate thing that there are huge stakes, especially in terms of water use and you know, energy use in general. But also asthma is a huge, I mean, that's just
definitely.
Sort of an obvious one, but it's a huge, huge problem in cities, especially in New York.
I have asthma.
Right.
And I smoke. Well. So I have bigger problems than,
you know, that's
the green one's not gonna do too much for you.
That's just one thing, but I think the big picture energy use is probably,
and definitely, you
know, and that goes for suburbs as well. I think the different scenarios are gonna feel pressures on different things first, but everyone's feeling pressure ecologically. Water's running out, energy's running out.
Well, I would ask, you know, I think people really understand what green architecture is in the sense that it's about energy efficiency and about, you know, changing your light bulbs and sun shade direction and so forth. But what is green landscape architecture, and what are we doing besides green roofs and living walls? Like how are we and xeriscaping? Mm-hmm. What other ways are we really taking steps towards creating sustainable landscapes?
Well, I think it really ties back to what Justine was saying before, and that connecting all of these separate things. I feel like a lot of the green architecture for buildings is very individualized little pieces, and I think landscape has potential to then take those benefits and connect them so that you have a greater impact, you know, the whole being more than the sum of the pieces.
I think as landscape architects, we have, you know, a sort of tool bag all these techniques we've talked about and many others, but it has to also be tied into policy and planning. You know, everybody has their role to play, and I mm-hmm. think we as landscape architects can be involved in so many different aspects of the built environment that it's a kind of a prime time for us.
A la the tax breaks that you get for building a green roof, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
And I mean, do you envision a moment where it will be illegal to build a non-green building? Will LEED certification ever become more than just something that's awarded as a badge of going above and beyond?
Well, you know, I don't know. I've been on LEED job sites, mm-hmm. and I'll tell you, they're far, far from being green as you might think about.
Yeah,
it, you know, and I think obviously LEED is great, you know, mm-hmm. in the sense that it's really pushing people to take steps and pushing developers to really take steps towards sustainability. You know, it's not the be all and end all, mm-hmm. But it is a great kind of first step for the industry.
Mm-hmm. It's making visible a set of things that
right.
most people don't ever see. So.
Well, so. I think that's kind of a big role of landscape architects, mm-hmm. is that making visible what you can do ecologically through design and getting people excited about it. Mm-hmm. It's not just about like checking off your little lead points. And right. I mean, that is important, and it's mm-hmm. the system is helping. But I think our role is, the biggest role is getting people excited about what the opportunities are.
It's very visible. It's tactile. It right. changes seasonally.
I'll tell you though, being a designer and a builder, lead is expensive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to be honest, a lot of the projects that we work on, you know, we would never apply for lead, mm-hmm. but everything that we do is sustainable. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think one of the things that comes up for me as a landscape architect is materiality, mm-hmm. Salvage, you know, craftiness. Thinking about, you know, we've done projects where every material that we used was found on site as part of some other building process that uh-huh. was going to be thrown away. Mm-hmm. Plywood.
Yeah, weren't you talking about a graffiti-related project?
Yeah, there were some graffiti-related projects, but a lot of other projects where, for example, we built tree planters made from wood pallets that mm-hmm. were going to be thrown away and plywood.
Mm-hmm. So repurposing is a big part of what you're doing.
Repurposing, absolutely. And I think, you know, this kind of ties into some really bigger conceptual ideas for me as a designer of a reappropriating materials. You know, it's almost like an alchemy process in a way, where you can take all these disparate things and somehow combine them into something that's greater than the original. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that there is some kind of essence of gold in there that is beautiful and at the same time really sustainable and is part of reusing. And I think I see so much of the building process where everything is thrown away. And, you know, I'm like, oh, I want that. And obviously there's a limit to what, what you can salvage, but there's a lot of work to be done there.
Yeah, but yeah, it's so sad to see that in a supposedly green project mm-hmm. that they aren't reusing anything. It's just all going in the dump. And you're like, is this really making a difference? Is it really making it better?
I mean, look at the structure we're in now. These are two repurposed shipping containers. Mm-hmm. They used to be used to move cargo.
Sure.
And they've been completely repurposed. I mean, this is almost as green a structure as you could have.
Definitely.
You know, so it's definitely a good model for sustainable design.
With the farm on top.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, people, money's tight. People are starting to get more interested in how they can reuse something and, you know, make it worth more. And so it's kind of it's a hard time, but it's also a really exciting time because I think the mainstream is becoming much more interested in these issues.
And previously radical notions. Mm-hmm.
Well,
and
I would just also say on that note, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of economics, it's also putting people back to work.
Yeah.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just buying something off the shelf. Mm-hmm. Salvage takes time. So you're spending less money on materials, mm-hmm. but you're probably spending a little bit more money on labor.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at this point in time, that's actually, it could be a very positive thing.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Absolutely. And do you also think that even though it's not directly related to the economy, that the economic downturn has made people drastically rethink the notions that they had for what is and is not working, and is maybe making them more open to previously sort of marginalized ideas like green landscape, like green design?
I think an example of, you know, productive landscape, David mentioned the term productive earlier, growing food is a really popular thing to do.
Definitely
right now.
Getting a lot more calls
getting a
about
lot
that.
More play. You know, the edible landscape is something that people are really interested in, and it's I think going to have an aesthetic effect as well as, you know, what looks like desirable is changing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's just one example, but
there's rooftop mm-hmm. farms popping up mm-hmm. all over the city. It's crazy. In Greenpoint, there's a massive one that's gotten mm-hmm. a lot of play in New York Magazine and New York Times Magazine. And I mean, how can productive landscapes like farms, nurseries, mm-hmm. orchards, pastures be incorporated into our future cities?
Well, I think you can look at a precedent in Seville, Spain. They have orange trees as street trees.
Huh.
And there's actually people that will go around and collect the oranges and sell them. So it's almost spawned a kind of you know, local ad hoc industry of sorts. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think the other, you know, kind of infrastructural thing that's happening in New York now, you know, we own a nursery for our own projects. It's all, you know, it's not a retail nursery, but it is on the Gowanus Canal, which is in Brooklyn and is one area of Brooklyn that is frequented by floods and is subject to a lot of the stormwater overflow issues and sewage, you know, basically raw sewage come down to the Gowanus Canal on a pretty frequent basis. So having a nursery there is great as terms of, you know, shortening the cycle of materials. Uh-huh. Our materials don't, you know, our green roof plants, for example, don't have to come from Connecticut or from Washington, D.C. They're coming from Brooklyn. They're grown there mm-hmm. and propagated. But it's also allowing us to, you know, green that part of Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as a kind of temporary landscape, mm-hmm. yeah, it's both productive, but it's also performative.
Interesting. So that's where you're preparing your... The nursery is where then you're going to transplant those trees or those plants into mm-hmm. your various projects. That's fascinating. And meanwhile, while they're waiting, while they're growing, they're also benefiting.
They're serving a purpose. Yeah.
Well, I think we all saw when we were in Philly at Penn some great examples of, I think, unlike New York, there are a lot of cities that are suffering a lot of blight right now and abandoned lots and dumping and using productive landscapes, tree nurseries and other types of landscapes like that gives people something to do. It gives people an investment in their neighborhood. It's an alternative to a house that nobody's living in. And it lowers crime. There are a lot of social benefits in cities that aren't doing so well that this kind of planting and industry can add to those cities.
Martha, do you have a nursery or a similar?
No, I only do design, no build.
Oh, okay. Only design, no build. Right. I see. And then do you? So you design something and then you hand it to someone like David who would execute it.
Right. Well, although David, do you do other people's designs or
I
just
don't,
your own?
Just my own.
Yeah, I usually go with. I have a few favorite contractors mm-hmm. in the city that they only build things. They mm-hmm. they don't do their own design.
Interesting. So. Shifting back to the suburban landscape, Justine, how can our suburban landscape be reclaimed by design or by ecology? And will anyone in the suburbs really care?
I think they are starting to care. It's a really tough question because there are a lot of cultural signs that are played out in suburban landscapes, including the lawn or a fence. And what people think is desirable is starting to change, but a lot of it is, you know, crap still, I have to say. But I think it's a process that is starting to happen because of the economics and because people are starting to understand how their ecological systems work. There's a huge fight outside of Atlanta going on. Well, but basically because of Atlanta, there's a huge water fight going on in the South. And people are going to have to change their gardening practices because Atlanta is basically taking all of the water from three states worth of aquifer. So, and it's a very public debate. So I think that it will change. It's just a matter of time and education.
And David, you were talking about, you touched upon the difference between performative and productive landscape design. Can you tell us a little bit about what those distinctions are for the layman?
I don't know if they're specific terms necessarily, but I do feel like they're terms that are kind of thrown around now when you're thinking of landscape as beyond just aesthetics. And performative, to me, really calls into question or brings to mind ecological landscapes, things that are going to perform better than a concrete surface or better than a lawn. All these different methods, you know, that we would use specific to a site, those might be performative. Green roof is one example. A drainage swale would be another example. And then I think you have to think also about productive landscapes as being a kind of separate typology. The urban farm, as we talked about, the orchard. You know, how can we introduce these different systems of landscape into our cities, because we are at a really critical moment, I think, in the history of the world, if you want to take the really big picture. More people are living in cities now than have ever lived in cities before. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of at a critical tipping point, so to speak. And as we move forward, what are our cities going to look like?
We're not only ours, but what are China's cities going to look like, for example?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you take something like New York, 8 million people or something. We feel like it's such a huge city. But when you look at the different cities around the world, China has 20 cities with 20 million people, for example. You know, what are these things doing? You know, what are these cities doing? What are the standards that are being put into place?
And those are the cities that are in the greatest danger if they don't start to take some initiatives towards greening, would you say?
I think towards greening, I think it really comes back to the issue of stormwater, you know, and water management is really going to be the key feature that actually creates this kind of monumental paradigm shift to happen.
Interesting. So, I mean, do you see any of these measures? Like, do you see any of these cities that you're thinking about taking measures to try to even start to tackle this issue, Martha? Or I mean, do you know any architects that are working in China?
Yeah, it's definitely a very big market for landscape architects, especially for like the kind of the bigger firms that we used to work for, where you know, you go over there and you're given the job of designing an entire new city, and which is exciting and you try to think of all these little details of everything can work together. But the frustrating part that I found with that is that, you know, you're not there when it's built and they don't have the whole system in place. And so like the contractors aren't following the plans, you know, exactly how it's supposed to work. And then it's just not all quite fitting together.
So they're outsourcing a lot of the intellectual and scientific work of actually designing the stuff to American architects?
Yeah, and European.
And Chinese. Yeah, I mean, I think there's just so much building going on in certain parts of the world. There's plenty of work for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And do you think all the new buildings that are going up, for example, I just saw a picture the other day of a new soccer stadium in South Africa that's going up in preparation for the World Cup next summer. Are these green? I mean, is every major new building in the world green?
No.
Not even close?
Not even close. I think a lot of the big American stadiums that are being built, especially, are not green.
Like the new Cowboys Stadium is not green, you would say?
I don't know, actually. I know the scoreboard's too low. But.
Yeah, that I know too. That's interesting. And I mean, did classmates of yours enter the design field, any of them that have entered the design field, are any of them specializing in building that isn't green? I mean, is the concept of becoming an architect or a landscape designer these days and being completely separated from the sustainable and green schools of thought, I mean, is that something that's even possible?
I don't know. I feel like where we went to school, it was such a focus. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's just a very small part of landscape architecture. I think a lot of the other schools, I mean, it's definitely a part of their focus, but
I think it's hard not to be aware of it, but it's a lot of it is the whole way you think. I mean, we came from a school that had a background in regional planning, so we're landscape architects, but we often think on a very large systemic scale. And that's something that all three of us and probably all of our classmates do, because that was the way that our program was built. But that's very unusual. I don't know of another school program that came from that kind of that macro scale. And then, you know, now we're working on this tiny scale, but it's not that we're always thinking about a bigger thing.
And this is this Jim Corner school of thought, as much as you guys hesitate to label it as such. Can you pin this notion down for us?
Well, I mean, I don't want to speak for him. He's very eloquent and a great writer. And I think he has influenced a whole generation of landscape architects, not just at Penn, but especially at Penn. But a lot of it is about a systems approach rather than an aesthetic approach. As David was talking about performative landscapes, it's how does it work? What's the function? How does it connect into all these other systems that we want to influence? And sometimes those systems are physical, sometimes they're political. It's kind of looking at looking at everything as a set of networked systems that need to work in concert with each other to have any kind of great effect.
Interesting. So you're saying that still to this day, the notion of green is not built in to the word architecture or design?
I don't know. I think in a lot of resumes that I get from graduating people, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Everybody's interested. Everybody's actually LEED accredited, which is kind of funny. But, you know, people...
But they're also applying to a green...
Future green.
That is true. That is true. Future green studio. So they better be. No, but I do think that there's a huge shift that's mm-hmm. happening with people. And I kind of spoke about it a little bit earlier, is this kind of return to craftsmanship. I do feel like a lot of people that I know that have advanced degrees, master's degrees, doctorates, are going back, they're leaving their desk jobs, and they're working with their hands, mm-hmm. and they're interested in sustainability and ways of actually changing the world. And it is about experiencing things, and it is about making meaningful spaces, community building spaces, mm-hmm. Things that you're not disconnected from. You're not just sitting behind a computer and drawing something that somebody in China will build, but there's actually a direct connection between what you're doing and what you're producing, and you can see the implications of that. I think that's really the impetus behind maybe a lot of us going off on our own.
Yeah,
but
that's
also,
exactly what I was about to say. It's I think it would be very hard, you know, if you get into a firm that they've had their style of design for, you know, the 20, 30 years they've been in business, and then when this whole green initiative starts coming in, you know, the new people are really excited about it, but how do you work that into the style that's already there? And that's what's mm-hmm. nice about having your own firm, is that you can really try things out right away.
Mm-hmm. You can set your own agenda.
Yeah.
Well, we're pretty close to wrapping up here, but I want to ask you one question before this panel breaks up. And that is, I know that Justine, you worked a little bit on the High Line, mm-hmm. on the renovation of the High Line. And I just want you guys, from the perspective of young practitioners of essentially what the High Line is meant to represent, what do you think of the finished product? What would you change? And what kind of hopes do you guys have for working on similar projects yourselves in the future?
Well, I love it. I was pretty blown away by it. It was exciting to see something. You know, I've been following along when I worked at another firm. You know, we worked on that competition. It's been just so exciting to see something actually happen. Like, if you look mm-hmm. at the renderings from the original competition to when it was built, they really made it happen, which is nice to see something that didn't get watered down. I mean, maybe it did some details, but...
Yeah, I think it's a monumental project in the history of landscape architecture. I think it's at the beginning of a new movement. There are definitely things within the project I could critique.
I think we all could. Yeah,
the light fixtures, mm-hmm. or, you know, certain things that maybe didn't fit in, you know, mm-hmm. with the overall aesthetic that was trying to be produced. And it was produced. It wasn't there. Right. It is artificial, but I still think it's just fabulous. As a space, and I think that we all spoke about the New York City has a landscape type. You see the green sign, you see the bench, you see the railing. You know, there's these really distinctive elements of a New York City park.
It's the Central Park aesthetic, yeah.
Yeah, but this kind of breaks down those barriers.
It's kind of a game changer for New York.
Definitely.
It's a new aesthetic. It's exciting to people.
But I mean, as it should be. I mean, the High Line couldn't be more different from Central Park. I mean, the original purpose of the area in which it was built was completely different from what Central Park was built to do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's apropos that it should be different.
The repurposing of an industrial structure is where that is what cities are going to do.
They have to.
Right. They have to. And they're doing it, but that's where it's at.
And you guys are going to be at the vanguard of that.
Yeah,
I would love to do a project like that someday, for sure.
I think that one of the most interesting things about that project is not the actual built product, mm-hmm. which is amazing, but the actual process of building it, mm-hmm. and the fact that it did take concerned citizens, neighborhood people, mm-hmm. Ended up being a lot of celebrities also that got involved. But
persistence.
Yeah, persistence. Yeah. Energy and persistence. People made it happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, every project should be so lucky to have such dedicated and persistent cheerleaders and advocates. You know, unfortunately, they don't all have those, but that's what it takes to make it happen.
On behalf of everyone here at Heritage Radio Network, I'd like to thank our guests tonight. Once again, you can find more information about their firms at www.vertny.com for Martha Desbians. Justine Heilner's website is www.justineheilner.com. And David Sider of Future Green Studio can be found at www.futuregreenstudio.com. Thanks for tuning into the Heritage Radio Network, and look for this program on the archives. Thanks, Hearst Ranch.